was having trouble. What a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Winter for Poland and France.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Come on, Germans, go into your dance.
I was born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Michelle Alexander explaining how the Get Tough on Crime policies that were enacted in the 1970s were an effort to push back on the gains of the civil rights movement.
Thank you so much for this warm welcome. It feels wonderful to be here. I am thrilled to see so many people eager to join in dialogue about where we as a nation find ourselves in the stride toward freedom. And it seems particularly fitting that we would have this conversation today, the day after our nation paused its daily business to pay tribute to Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and his legacy. And it seems fitting that we would have this conversation the day after our nation's first black president was sworn in for his second term. Now, I know much of the nation has already moved on, and President Obama's soaring rhetoric about the promise of America, life, liberty, justice, equality for all, has already been forgotten by many. And I know that many, many people in America will not think of Dr. King again until his holiday rolls around again next year. But I'd like for us to pause tonight and think more deeply about the meaning of Dr. King's life and his legacy and what it has to teach us about our nation's present. It seems particularly important for us to do that given that this year marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. 50 years have passed. 50 years have passed since King's voice soared over the Washington monuments, declaring his dream. I have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. And yesterday, while I was watching President Obama's inaugural address, I heard echoes of King's speech, "I have a dream." And when I turned off my television set, I spent a few minutes reflecting on the question, are all of us, truly welcome to share in this dream, the same dream that Dr. King dreamed? Most Americans, I'm sure, can recite portions of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech by heart. It's an extraordinary and very familiar speech. I've grown accustomed to hearing clips of his speech played over and over, recycled over and over on the radio every January. They are the favorite quotes, the favorite lines. And now that I have school-age children, I see how King is explained to them in classrooms. When I was in elementary school, there was no Martin Luther King Day, no discussion of his heroism in classrooms. But when my children came home from school just the other day, they told me all they had learned in school about King's courage. He was the man who stood up to the bullies, the man who believed that children of all colors and walks of life ought to be able to hold hands and be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skins. He was willing to die so that all of us could now live his dream. And I find myself conflicted as I listen to my children parrot back to me what they've heard in school about this man who believed in kindness and forgiveness and justice and compassion for all. And I say, yes, yes, all of that is untrue. All of that is true. But I feel uneasy. I know that something has been lost in the translation. And that sense of disorientation was crystallized for me recently when I read Vincent Harding's insightful book, Martin Luther King, The Inconvenient Hero. Dr. Harding was one of King's closest friends and advisors, marching with him countless times and living around the corner from King's family in Atlanta. Harding writes with some real sorrow, quote, "It appears as if the price for the first national holiday honoring a black man is the development of a massive case of national amnesia concerning who that black man really was. I would suggest that we Americans have chosen amnesia rather than continue King's painful, uncharted, and often disruptive struggle toward a more perfect union," end quote. "It appears," he says, "as if we are determined to hold our new hero captive to the powerful period of his life that culminated in the magnificent March on Washington in 1963, refusing to allow him to break out beyond the stunning eloquence of his I Have a Dream speech." Dr. Harding writes, quote, "We would like to forget that it was not the weaver of gentle sunny dreams of freedom who was shot down on a balcony in Memphis, Tennessee," end quote. He was, by 1968, a different, even more courageous man, a man ahead of his time. And I can see clearly now that on days like yesterday, we rarely honor the man who died. No, we honor that sunny, cheery version of him. We honor the man who gave the soaring speech about black and white school children, a man who dreamed an integrationist dream. But who was King 5 years later in 1968? Who was that man killed on a motel balcony? The man who was marching with sanitation workers and demanding economic justice, not mere civil rights. The man who had come to believe after the civil rights bills had already been passed, after the civil rights victories had already been won, that our biggest battles, the most important battles, still lie ahead. And that nothing, nothing short of a radical restructuring of our society held any hope for making the dream and promise of America a reality for all of its citizens. King explained to a reporter in 1967, quote, "For years, I labored with the idea of reforming the existing institutions of the society. A little change here, a little change there. Now I feel quite differently. I think you've got to have a reconstruction of the entire society, a revolution of values." Frustrated by white resistance to addressing in any meaningful way, decaying ghettos, failing schools, structural joblessness, and crippling poverty. King told his staff at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, quote, "The dispossessed of this nation, the poor, both white and Negro, live in a cruelly unjust society. They must organize a revolution against that injustice, not against the lives of their fellow citizens, but against the structures through which the society is refusing to lift the load of poverty." So what would King think of us today, of the world we have created in his absence? Would he believe that the nonviolent revolution had already been won, had even begun? The revolution of values that he prayed for? Would he, if he could see us today, believe that we now share his dream, that we are now traveling the road he was marching? 50 years later, have we caught up with King yet? Are we finally on the path that he was traveling in 1963, 1968? Back in 1969, while blood still stained the motel balcony where Dr. King was murdered, a poem was written honoring his life and reflecting on his death. The poem was written back when King had only just begun the process of being transformed in our collective consciousness from a troublesome, dangerous black figure to a national hero. It was written way back when the memory of King's assassination was still fresh, tears still spilling among those who loved him. Back then, in 1969, the poet Carl Wendell Himes Jr. penned this poem reflecting on King's death. He wrote, "Now that he is safely dead, let us praise him. Build monuments to his glory. Sing hosannas to his name. Dead men make such convenient heroes. They cannot rise to challenge the images we would fashion from their lives. And besides, it is easier to build monuments than to build a better world. So now that he is safely dead, we, with eased consciences, will teach our children that he was a great man, knowing that the cause for which he lived is still a cause, and the dream for which he died is still a dream, a dead man's dream. Now that he is safely dead." Martin Luther King Jr., safely dead. Is it true? Is he safely dead today? Is his dream safely dead?
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Now, I know that many people in this room would say, no, no, no. Dr. King's dream, his spirit is still so much alive amongst all of us. It's thriving right here in this room. And what better evidence could there be of this fact than that we, as a nation, all paused to pay tribute to his dream just yesterday? A national federal holiday. Think about that. A national federal holiday for Martin Luther King Jr., the man who was once deemed a threat to national security by the FBI, a radical troublemaker. Is it not obvious that we as a nation have finally caught up with King? We may not be living his dream, but don't we at least share his dream? What better evidence of this could there be than that we just re-elected our nation's first black president? Something that was unimaginable in 1963 or 1968. What better evidence could there be than that beautiful, multiracial, multi-ethnic gathering on the Mall in Washington, D.C. that we witnessed just yesterday and that was broadcast around the world? Clearly, we must be living the dream or sharing the dream, right? It has been said by numerous philosophers and theologians that any society, any civilization, must be judged by how it treats its most vulnerable members and its prisoners. King would no doubt agree with that assessment. And in considering how we fare in that regard, I find myself thinking of people like Susan Burton, people who have cycled in and out of our nation's prison system in this era of mass incarceration, in this post-King, post-civil rights era, a time when our prison population has more than quintupled and millions of people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, have been permanently locked up or locked out, stripped of the very civil and human rights Dr. King and so many others risked their lives for and some even died for. I think of Susan, whose son was killed by the police. A police cruiser barreling down her street in Los Angeles ran over her 5-year-old boy. She received no apology, no real acknowledgement of her loss, and she fell into a deep, deep depression, racked with grief, and she ultimately became addicted to crack cocaine. Now, if Susan had been wealthy, if she had even been solidly middle class with a good job and a good health care plan, she undoubtedly would have qualified for many, many hours of therapy and counseling. She likely would have qualified for very good legal prescription drugs that would help her cope with her severe depression and grief. But no, things were different for Susan. Impoverished, living in L.A., she became addicted to crack cocaine and thus began her odyssey of cycling in and out of prison for 15 years. 15 years. Every time, prosecutors said, just take the deal. We'll give you 3 years rather than 8. This time we'll give you 5 years rather than 12. This time we'll cut you a break. Just take the deal. We'll give you 2 years rather than 6. One plea deal after another. Never offered drug treatment, only shown to a prison cell. Every time she was released, pushed out onto the streets, unable to find work, no housing, often sleeping on the streets, cycling in and out of our prison system for 15 years until, by no small miracle, she was granted access to a private drug treatment facility. She got clean and was given a job. And she decided that she was going to dedicate the rest of her life to ensuring that no other woman would have to go through what she went through. And she began by going down to Skid Row in Los Angeles and meeting women, prisoners, as they would get off the prison bus on Skid Row. Get off the bus carrying nothing but a cardboard box carrying their belongings, little or no money, turned out on the street. And she would say to these women who were strangers to her, just come home with me. You can sleep on my couch. You can sleep on my floor. You don't have to turn to the streets. I'll take care of you. I'll give you food. I'll give you a safe place. Just come home with me. Susan Burton now runs 5 safe homes for women in Los Angeles. Women released from prison. Her organization is called A New Way of Life. She provides help finding jobs, housing, helps to reunite women with their families. And beyond that, she is organizing formerly incarcerated people to demand the restoration of their basic civil and human rights. Clearly, Susan has caught up to King. But what about the rest of us? Now, what I have to say on this point will not be popular. It is not the sunny, cheerful message that is expected on the day after we inaugurated for the second time our nation's first black president. But I believe it to be the truth. And it implicates me, and it implicates everyone in this room. And the truth is this. We have allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. In the years since Dr. King's death, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged from the ashes of slavery and Jim Crow. A system of mass incarceration that no doubt has Dr. King turning in his grave today. The mass incarceration of poor people of color in the United States is tantamount to a new caste-like system, one that shuttles our young people from decrepit, underfunded schools to brand new high-tech prisons. It is a system that locks poor people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, into a permanent second-class status nearly as effectively as earlier systems of racial and social control once did. It is, in my view, the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, I am always eager to admit that there was a time when I rejected this kind of talk out of hand. There was a time when I rejected comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery and mass incarceration and Jim Crow, believing that those kinds of claims and comparisons were exaggerations, were distortions, were hyperbole. In fact, there was a time when I thought that people who made those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were actually doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. But what a difference a decade makes. For after years of working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate, representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality, and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color, and attempting to assist people who have been released from prison, re-enter into a society that had never shown much use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is just so obvious to me now, that what seems odd in retrospect is that I could have been blind to it for so long. As I write in the introduction to my book, The New Jim Crow, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of color blindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices that we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. Now, for those who might think that's overstating the case, consider this. There are more African-American adults under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. As of 2004, more black men were disenfranchised than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, explicitly denying the right to vote on the basis of race. The 15th Amendment prohibited all laws, explicitly denied the right to vote on the basis of race. But during the Jim Crow era, poll taxes and literacy tests circumvented the 15th Amendment and operated to deny African Americans a chance to vote. Well, today, in many states, felon disenfranchisement laws accomplish what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. Now, this doesn't affect just some small segment of the African American community. To the contrary, in many large urban areas today, more than half of working age African American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In fact, in some cities, like Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, D.C., the list could go on. In some cities, the statistics are far worse. In fact, it was reported in Chicago that if you take into account prisoners, if you actually count prisoners as people, and keep in mind that prisoners are excluded from poverty statistics and unemployment data, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you actually count prisoners as people, in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working-age African-American men criminal records are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I find today that when I tell people that I now believe that mass incarceration is like a new Jim Crow, a new caste-like system, people react with this complete disbelief. They just say, how can you say that? How can you say that? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control, it's a system of crime control. And if black folks would just stop running around committing so many crimes, we wouldn't have to worry about being locked up and then stripped of their civil and human rights. Well, therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's just not true.
Socialists we got out there tonight. Come on, let's see a show of left hands. You drive here on a public street, socialist. You go to a public school, socialist. You ever visit a public library? Why? I'll tell you why, because you're a socialist. Like Ulysses S. Grant. Yellowstone National Park. You ever been there? Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Teddy Pinko Roosevelt. That guy was talking about universal health care. You're taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating socialist. My dog got run over by a truck, and the socialist animal control people came and picked up my dog. Then my neighbor's house caught on fire, and the socialist fire department came and put it out. I could have snatched up that dog and cooked it on my neighbor's house. Another good meal ruined by socialism. You ever mail a letter? Of course you have, because you're a socialist. Like Dwight D. Eisenhower. That guy built highways between the states. Yeah, you're a socialist. like Richard Red Diaper Nixon. He put food stamps on people's plates. Yeah, you're a tax satan, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating socially. How many socialists does it take to screw in a light bulb? Too many. Four to requisition the light bulb. Four more to process the requisition in triplicate. Eight to manufacture the light bulb. Three to subsidize the manufacturing. Three to procure the light bulb. Two to supervise the manufacturing and procurement process. Seven to warehouse the light bulb for an indeterminate length of time. Four to deliver the light bulb to the wrong address. Four more to re-deliver the light bulb. Six to receive the light bulb. And one to screw it up. 47. How many capitalists does it take to screw in a light bulb? Two. One impoverished nation willing to exploit its malnourished population and rape its natural resources to manufacture, package, and deliver the light bulb to Walmart. And me. You know why that's funny? Because you're a socialist. Like Ronald W. Reagan. Earned income tax credit. Yeah, you're a socialist. Like George W. SSR Bush. That guy wrote the book on government interference. Of course, he never read it. You're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating, Stalin hugging, Castro kissing, Marx belating, spawn of Satan, socialist. Every last one of ya.
And now for something completely different.